Good afternoon, everyone. I'm medical oncologist Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Exploring the Current Management Paradigm of Patients with Metastatic Triple-Negative Breast Cancer. Tonight's program is part of a project we did with the Florida Cancer Specialists, a group we've been working with for at least 15 years. We just did their weekend retreat, and you'll see how they helped us with this program tonight. We have a great faculty on this webinar, Dr. Priyanka Sharma, from the University of Kansas Cancer Center in Westwood, Kansas, and Dr. Sarah Tulaney from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. Today, we're going to talk about triple-negative breast cancer, and you know, there are a lot of programs out there on triple-negative breast cancer. There's a lot of interest in that, particularly, of course, the issue of antibody-drug conjugates. But, you know, we try to take a more rounds-like approach to things, and that's what we're doing today. Not going to show you many or really any data slides. We're just here to make rounds with our faculty. And we will be talking about the use of agents that are not approved and regimens that are not approved. So check out package inserts for more information. So we're really in a case presentation kind of mood and a short video mood. Last Saturday, many of you were online and a bunch of you were in Dallas for our meeting with the American Oncology Network. We presented like 40 cases from these six oncologists there. And today we have two docs from the Florida Cancer Specialists who not only took the survey, but met with me individually on a Zoom call. I picked out a few of their questions and cases. Dr. Sachi Gupta from West Palm Beach, Florida. Dr. Mian Hussein from the Villages in Florida. Dr. Hussein's also the current president of FLASCO, the Florida Society of Clinical Oncology. So we're mainly going to just go through eight videos. Each one's about a minute and get the faculty's reaction to it. But I just want to start out by reflecting back on something we did last week for the first time. As you can imagine, we've done hundreds, literally, of webinars like this one tonight for physicians and nurses. But last week, for the first time, we actually did a program for patients. And this was on this same topic of triple-negative breast cancer metastatic disease with Dr. Carey from University of North Carolina, Dr. Nanda from the University of Chicago. And we integrated video into that. I met with eight patients individually on Zoom and recorded some comments and questions they have. We put it online for you to, your patients to check out. But I have that experience in my mind. I'm going to reflect back as we go through this today a little bit about some of the things that I heard from patients. The other thing is we did a survey of the Florida Cancer Specialists. We had 34 oncologists who participated in the survey. We asked their usual approach to triple negative disease. And I was really just mainly interested to see. One thing we asked them was how long was the patient on therapy. I wanted to see how it lined up with what we've seen in trials. But I wasn't expecting what I saw there about sequencing. We're about to show you what we saw there. It was a little bit surprising. Not going to say it's right or wrong. You know, a lot of times in oncology, there are multiple evidence-based options, but I was a little surprised. And I think maybe what we saw was reflects a lot of excitement about, frankly, about T-DXd in general and HER2-low and ultra-low specifically. Of course, we were there at ASCO in 2022 when we first saw the original HER2-low data, and then it was immediately published in the New England Journal. We actually did a CME program the day after the data were presented, and the first question we asked was, how are you going to sequence these patients? And as we'll talk about, and we'll hear from our faculty, one answer we got pretty consistently that night, and we've gotten pretty much from investigators, at least in triple-negative disease, was that sacituzumab generally comes first, even in patients who are eligible to receive T-DXd. But that's not quite exactly what we saw in the survey, and I'm really curious to see what the faculty thinks about that. And then, of course, even more excitement came out at this past ASCO with the ultra-low. Of course, that was ER positive, and the paper there. We did a symposium right after that as well as ASCO. I didn't see the faculty change very much about sequencing at that point. And another issue that brought a lot of attention at TDXD was, the pan-tumor approval for IH3+, and now the lung people and the colon people and everybody else, biliary tract and much, much more, GYN, et cetera, have that as an option. Oncologists are thinking a lot about that. So just want to sort of keep that in the back of our mind as we start to get into some of the key issues in triple negative disease. And we're going to start out with the mainly focus on the issue of the ADCs, because that's where we get a lot of questions. And I think there are a lot of, you know, controversies there that I really want to get into as part of that. So faculty, you can check out this first comment from Dr. Gupta, who was asking about, again, one of the big issues right now is sequencing of ADCs.
We always have this question about the sequencing of antibody drug conjugates. It seems like the first antibody drug conjugate works better than the second. But also, I see that we have newer drugs coming in this landscape of triple negative, like datopotamab, and it seems also patritumab. Just not sure, you know, where in the landscape would it fit. At this time, I tend to use sacituzumab first, only because of the survival data. Second, I feel like it's a little easier for me to use as compared to T-DXd, especially with regards to pneumonitis. And I see that most of the trials with regards to T-DXd are being done in ER-positive HER2-low or HER2-ultra-low setting. Where do we stand with our ER-negatives? I have seen some clinical trials. We had some open here where you could use sacituzumab in combination with immune therapy or not, depending on the PD-L1 status.
So I was actually joking with Sarah that she was actually, this all reminds me, we used to do a series called Visiting Professor, where we would actually literally send investigators out to the offices of medical oncologists. And Sarah was on one of the last CDs we did. Actually, it was in 2018. We sent her out to a little town in Indiana, and then you saw a bunch of the doc's patients, and then we talked about it on these CDs. Of course, you were not in the cassette era, before some of our audience may remember these things that we used to do for many, many years. So, Sarah, this is like the 2024 version of Visiting Professor. I don't know if you have any great recollections of flying out there to Indiana and went into their practice, and then maybe begin the discussion of some of the points brought up by Dr. Gupta as well.
Yeah, well, that was a lot of fun, actually. We got to see people, you know, with the physician in clinic, which was great. But certainly this is nice, too, to be able to hear about what people are experiencing now. So I think the big question Dr. Gupta is really raising is, how do we think about sequencing therapies for metastatic triple-negative disease, particularly with availability of antibody drug conjugates, and also how is that going to be in the future with new ADCs that are coming our way? So right now we do have sacituzumab govitecan for metastatic triple negative disease, and also have T-DXd if someone has metastatic triple negative disease that is also HER2 low. So I think the question often arises, well, what if you have someone who's got metastatic triple negative breast cancer that is also HER2 low? Which drug are you going to give first? And there's certainly not a wrong or right answer here, but I would agree with Dr. Gupta that I also tend to use sacituzumab govitecan first, simply because we have level one evidence for it in metastatic triple negative disease that comes from the ASCENT trial, really showing that sacituzumab led to significant improvements in both PFS and OS. Whereas with T-DXd, the data that we have comes from DESTINY-Breast04, where there were only 58 patients in that trial that had triple negative disease. So it's a very small subset. And so the precision around the, you know, estimate for improvements in PFS and OS are obviously just not going to be as tight. And so I will typically use sacituzumab first and T-DXd second. Problem is, we don't really have great data for efficacy of the second ADC post the first.
And Priyanka, I should mention, too, that we're only showing 15 graphics from the survey we did. We'll get to that in a minute. But there's a whole ton of other ones in the appendix, another 25 from the survey. And if you want to look up all the data or some of the data, that's also in the appendix. We're just here to talk. Priyanka, anything you want to add to that? And also this question of IO plus ADC, you know, bladder cancer, now first-line therapy, always super excited. And enfortumab vedotin, which maybe is going to come to breast cancer, plus Pembro. Dr. Gupta brought up these trials are starting to look at SASE plus IO. Any thoughts about that? And also her question about where Dato or patritumab and these other ADCs are going to fit in.
So first, I completely agree with both Dr. Gupta
and Sarah, that, you know, in a triple negative breast cancer patient with metastatic disease, I usually pick sacituzumab first, even if the disease is HER2-low, just because of the phase 3 data. In terms of, you know, the first line studies, obviously, you know, we see how effective these ADCs are in second and third line settings. So it makes complete rational sense to study it in the first line setting. So ASCENT-03 and 04 are the sacituzumab trials, looking at the combination of sacituzumab either with pembrolizumab in PD-L1 positive setting, or monotherapy in comparison to treatment of physician's choice. And we're eagerly awaiting those trials. I think both of those trials have completed accrual, so we should hopefully have some data within the next year or 18 months. And if they do show significant advantage over the chemotherapy of physician's choice in first-line setting, I think that's a win-win for our patients. One thing I have notice with sacituzumab is once you figure out how to manage the neutropenia, it is a drug you can keep people on for years. Like, I have people on it for 3, 4, 5 years. It doesn't seem to have any cumulative toxicity that will force you to stop the drug, even though it is working. And we don't have any chemotherapy drugs like that. Most of them will run into cumulative toxicities, primarily neuropathy or fatigue. I don't see that much fatigue with sacituzumab either. You can give little breaks, you know, give 2 or 3 weeks break in between two cycles, and the patients will bounce back. Hair loss is an issue, obviously. But overall, it just, you know, there's better quality of life for patients who are able to take it very long. In terms of the other ADCs, yes, you know, it's exciting times. We have many other ADCs in the pipeline coming in. One of the challenges is that the payload for most of them is a similar type of, it may be a different drug, but it is attacking the same aspect, right? So we just don't know how the second ADC with the same payload will work. And a lot of it now hinges upon more research and trying to figure out the resistance mechanisms, which might not be one. I mean, there might be many different things that contribute to it. Our ability to more accurately quantify the target might help us be more precise. You know, right now, TROP2 we think is expressed in 90%+, so we don't need to check it, but not every tumor has the same level of TROP2 expression. And HER2, we know, is a whole, you know, spectrum. And so if we can be more precise in the actual amount of target in each tumor, maybe there are situations where one ADC should come before the other one because of the amount of target present.
I want to also mention how grateful we are to these physicians for exposing their treatment patterns for you all to sort of look at. Dr. Gupta is about to, and going to be presenting a case where she used T-DXd first, incidentally. I'm going to get your thoughts about that, but we really appreciate these docs doing that. In a second, we're going to hear from Dr. Hussain, but, you know, we have like the best chat room, as you both know, and they're already reading my mind. And Sarah Hassan brought up an issue I remember I talked about with you the last time we did a recording. He brings up the issue of a patient who has ER5, PR0, and is that ER low or is it triple negative? I know you've done some work on that. How are you approaching those patients nowadays, Sarah?
Yeah, if someone's ER5%, PR0, HER2-0, you know, that's a triple negative patient in my mind. They have a teeny bit of estrogen receptor, but they functionally behave like a triple negative breast cancer. Even when you look, for example, at the biology of these cancers, the intrinsic subtyping of these cancers is most often basal-like, and so ends up, again, behaving very much like triple negative disease. So I will approach them, you know, similarly.
So Priyanka can never remember the name of your trial looking at your regimen versus 522, but do you allow these sort of ER lows in there?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So the Scarlet study is allowing up to 5% ER/PR. Yes. So I think that'll be one of the first large trials that includes a good proportion of these patients. So we might generate more closer to level one evidence for this subgroup, even though we all treat them like triple negative.
So let's get a little bit more into some of the questions, and then we're going to do a case here. This is from Dr. Hussain, and more questions about using ADCs.
Sassy, my question is, would you go to 7.5 or would you still start with the 10 mg per kg first and see if they tolerate it? I use the implant too and other indication, and none of them can tolerate the 10. I always have to drop it. So that's one question. The second question, would you do prophylaxis G-CSF or would you wait till they become neutropenic? Have you played with the schedule? With Sassy, fatigue is a big thing. Of course, pancytopenia and diarrhea, those are the ones that really I struggle with managing with patients. With trastuzumab deruxtecan is really the pneumonitis, the shortness of breath. One of the patients that I treated, she had history of mycoplasma, so she already have lung disease. And it was very hard to tell, is her breathing worse because of the treatment or is it because of like a reactivation of her myco? I had to work with the ID doc and with the pulmonologist, and it was really challenging. I had to stop it. So I feel that can be challenging, especially if they have lung mets, because it's hard to tell. Is it from the lung mets that they're short of breath or is it from the treatment?
Any other questions for the faculty?
How important are anthracyclines in treating triple-negative patients? Would you make sure that they get exposed to anthracycline before you go to different lines of therapy? Let's say they fail albumin-bound paclitaxel with Pempro or other immune therapies.
So, Sarah, it's amazing how many questions somebody can ask in a minute. And you know, I was reflecting back. One of the neatest comments from the patients last week was a patient who got started on full-dose SASE, had a bunch of problems with diarrhea, then they dose-reduced her, and she was fine. And she's like, why don't they start low and go up? I've heard that from oncologists as well. But any thoughts about the many questions Dr. Hussain just brought up, including dose and schedule?
Yeah, no, they're all excellent questions. So, you know, with sacituzumab, I typically do use the standard starting dose at 10, you know, day one, day eight on every 21-day cycle. I do typically think about prophylactic growth factor, though, in some patients. So I don't use it in everyone, but in someone who maybe is required growth factor with their last drug, so I already know someone has, you know, borderline blood counts and is requiring growth factor support, or maybe someone comes in to start therapy and their blood counts are a little bit borderline, like the ANC is like, you know, just over 1,000. It's not that robust. They're an older patient who may not have a lot of marrow reserve. Maybe they've had prior platinum with not a great marrow. Those people, I am starting on prophylactic growth factor. And when I do growth factor, I will give it after day one and after day eight. So I'll usually use filgrastim on days 2, 3, 4, and then pegfilgrastim on day 9. And that usually covers them through, but, you know, the whole cycle. Sometimes you can get away with just a day 9 dose, but it's very, you know, dependent on the individual. But I typically only dose reduce for other symptoms, because I usually find that I can get away with just growth factor to maintain blood counts. But if someone does have fatigue or issues with diarrhea that aren't controlled with, you know, supportive measures, then dose reduction definitely helps with that. And then with the schedule, it's also a really interesting question. His third question was, you know, do we always stick with day one, day eight on a 21-day cycle? For the most part, I do. I will say I do have one patient where I've had made that exception that she kept missing day eight. She really just couldn't do it. And it wasn't from a blood count perspective. She, I think, has other underlying GI issues not related to the sacituzumab that predisposed her to just having a lot of trouble with nausea. And even on a very tiny dose of sacituzumab, has only been able to do every 21-day administration. So, you know, I will say I have one patient like that, but that's pretty atypical. Everyone else is on day one and day eight.
So Priyanka, I was saying, I feel like we talk about ADCs every day, regardless of what tumor we're talking about. Actually, at the AON meeting last Saturday, we did an entire module on ADCs and lung cancer. And there, this issue that Dr. Hussain brought up of coexisting pulmonary disease, of course, much more common, COPD, et cetera. Any thoughts about how much or what kind of, you know, here the mycoplasma was sort of an active problem and he couldn't figure out what was going on. How do you approach the issue of people with prior lung problems in terms of TDXD? And also Screen Nissa in the chat room brings up something I've never heard of before. Maybe it's just a coincidence. She wants to know, how often do you see severe pruritus with sacituzumab?
So I'll talk about the underlying lung disease. You know, it is very common for our breast cancer patients to have lung disease when they get to this stage. What I try to pay attention to is their prior history of pneumonitis with prior drugs. Like if somebody's had pneumonitis with a CDK4/6 inhibitor or an mTOR inhibitor or prior immunotherapy in a triple negative setting, it makes me real hesitant. The other thing that I've started to pay attention to is baseline kidney dysfunction, because there's some data that suggests that patients who have at least moderate to severe kidney dysfunction are more predisposed to developing pneumonitis. The other challenging aspect is patients who may have needed radiation. Especially, we see that especially in our patients with triple negative disease that have early relapses, right? They got chest wall radiation for, you know, their bad triple negative disease. Now they have recurrence within 8, 9, 10 months, and you see the radiation changes on the first CT you get. So you kind of have to be watchful of it. I'm a little bit of a conservative in terms of when I'm watching for it. I typically will do scans every 9 weeks on all my TDXT patients. And the ones that I worry about, I will get the first scan at 6 weeks, just like the trials did, just so that we're keeping tabs on it.
So we're going to go into actually a case from Dr. Gupta, as I was referring to before, but I can't resist this case in the chat room, Sarah from Abdul. Patient with triple negative disease, status book surgery, ACT, TH for progression, now has brain mets when SASE, but her systemic disease is stable. It sounds like a kind of the old HER2 thing, you know, everything's stable, but now the patient brain met. Would you radiate the brain met or treat it locally to keep the SASE going or switch? She doesn't say whether or not the patient's HER2 low and whether that might be an option. Any thought about that case before we get into Dr. Gupta's case?
Yeah, these are always challenging. You know, if that patient's new brain met is amenable to stereotactic radiation, then I would generally do SRS to the brain met and continue the existing drug that's keeping the systemic, you know, disease under control. So that is generally my approach. And then if someone developed progression thereafter, then certainly would change the systemic treatment at that time point.
All right, well, let me let you take a look at this case, because this is the one case that really I thought was interesting. Because again, you're going to see the survey, and I don't know the right answer. So many times in oncology, there are multiple evidence-based options. We just like to ask investigators, like, what do you do? That's because we know that's what everybody else is asking you, but a lot of times you might, you know, have a feeling about doing something, and sometimes there's level one evidence, and other times it's hard to separate out. But this issue of whether SASE should come before TDXD and a patient who's HER2 low comes up here with Dr. Gupta, who filled out the survey saying she used SASE first, but here she used TDXD. Here it is.
This patient actually presented with disease in her breast and axilla. She was locally advanced, ER 60%, and HER2 was 2+. And so we started to work her up to gear towards surgery. But as it turns out, we imaged her and we found liver lesions. The liver biopsy results came back as triple negative HER2 2+. So she also started to manifest abnormal liver enzymes, increased bilirubin, so had to be emergently started on chemotherapy. She was PD-L1 negative, so I put her on carboplatin and gemcitabine. She had a good response. Her liver enzymes started to improve right away. She responded to it for around 5 months. At that point, I really wanted a good response, so I reached out for TDXD. Somewhere in my head, I feel that TDXD would respond better than sacituzumab. So, you know, I wonder when you compare two different antibody drug conjugates like TDXD versus sacituzumab or datopotamab, which one has a quicker onset of action? And she indeed had a great response. She did develop grade 2 ILD, which we treated. She had a dry cough, shortness of breath. We treated her with 1 mg/kg prednisone, prolonged taper, but by that time she progressed, and then I was able to switch her to sacituzumab govitecan. She had a good response to it, responded for around 4 months. I also add a growth factor day 8.
So Priyanka, very interesting. I guess one of the issues about using TDXD is you may see pneumonitis. In this case, the patient progressed while they're still on the steroids. Any thoughts about this? And I don't know, of course, it's always an indirect comparison, but what about response rate and time to response? Any thoughts, data, clinical experience, again, SASE versus TDXD?
I think the SASE trial is a later line trial compared to the TDXD trial. So it's hard to compare like the response rates across the two of them. But at the lines at which the trials were done, both of those drugs well passed the response rates with treatment of chemotherapy of physician's choice. So I think if we compare them the same lines, I would suspect the response rates would be about the same. And the same goes for duration of response in PFS. You know, as Dr. Gupta pointed out, you know, the second ADC tends to work less compared to the first one, no matter how you sequence them. That's what we've seen from real world and retrospective data. There's also this question of the ER positivity of 60% in the breast. And I wonder, you know, if that is something that potentially should be looked at any further in terms of ctDNA testing to see if there's a PI3 kinase or AKT mutation or some other insight.
Yeah, we might get into that later. I wanted to let you take a look, and I'm going to get Sarah's thoughts about this case. But also, I want you to take a look, Sarah, at the survey results we got in light of these questions that Dr. Gupta was honest enough to bring up to us. So this is from these 34 docs that we surveyed. We presented a bunch of scenarios. So I don't know if there is any more HER2 negative anymore, but let's say you do decide somebody's IHC zero, you can't find anything anywhere. We made these cases CPS is zero, but in terms of this question of sequence ADC, we didn't see much difference based on whether or not they'd have first-line IO or not. And you can see that when we pull TDXD out of the issue, most people go with what we've been hearing. I don't remember any time we did a survey or webinar or anything where people said anything different about triple negative. ER positive, that's HER2, that's another story. But here, SASE. But then we bring in, first of all, we bring in ultra low, which wasn't even in the ultra low paper at ASCO because that was ER positive. And already you can see half the people or a lot of people are already thinking about TDXD. When we bring it up to 1+ or 2+, now most people are thinking about TDXD first, maybe because of this quote feeling about response rate as well. We asked the same kind of questions. We got the same kind of answers. In a patient, the first case was a patient with de novo. We said, okay, suppose they had, neoadjuvant IO chemo. Again, still IHC zero. Everybody or most people are either going to do chemo again. I guess part of it might relate to reimbursement as well and sacituzumab. But then we bring in 1+ and again, we're seeing TDXD. 2+, a lot more TDXD. Before we get to this next really interesting thing, Sarah, any thoughts about what you've seen so far? Any thoughts about this case? What do you think about response rate and time to response based on clinical or whatever?
You know, it's a tough question because we have such limited amount of data for patients getting TDXD for triple negative breast cancer. And the response rate was 50% in the DB04 subset. So it's very impressive activity. But as Priyanka noted, you know, it's hard to do side-by-side comparisons to the ASCENT trial with sacituzumab because, you know, that trial was in essence second line and beyond, whereas DB04 was for people who had 1 to 2 prior lines of chemo. So you're not comparing apples and apples, right? You're comparing people who are getting treated in different lines of therapy. And so we don't have great data in the same setting to understand differences in time to response rate, PFS, OS in the same patient population. And so really we're just making this judgment call based on, you know, amount of data available, but you can see by the survey that you did that people are feeling a little, which is interesting because while Priyanka and I both said we probably would give sacituzumab first, here you're seeing most people, if there's any level of HER2 expression, tend to give TDXD first. And, you know, I think it's, I would guess in part it's because they know there's a target there. And so they say, why not give the ADC where there's, you know, that's targeting that target. And, you know, again, it's not wrong. Certainly, I think it's very reasonable to do, but we just don't have as much data. There is a trial that's just starting to enroll, Destiny Breast 15, which will allow patients who have triple negative breast cancer, both with some HER2 expression or HER2 zero. And so we will get more data in this setting to understand efficacy. But just right now, we're a little bit more limited.
And, you know, it's interesting, too. We were talking about ADC after ADC. And actually, this patient had a good response to SASE after TDXD, although We never know how long the response would have been on TDXD if they hadn't gotten grade 2 ILD. Here, we actually found 18 cases. We had 132 cases where mainly we were looking at how long they were on therapy. That was what I thought we were going to look at, and I didn't expect this. So we had 18 cases out of the 132 that got both. So presumably HER2 low and ER negative. And you can see a bunch of, you know, what they say they do is what they do. You know, half of the time they got TDXD first as well. Those asterisks mean they're still on therapy. So in terms of time on therapy, it's probably a little bit longer than what we have for median. Interesting, too, that most people, even though the study looked at ER positive ultra low, most people feel like they can bring that into triple negative disease. We can talk about whether or not we actually have a case, if we're going to get to it, of HER2 mutant disease. Of course, in lung cancer, that's the first place they started using TDXD. They use it first line, and maybe because general oncologists have that experience, they're ready to do it with HER2 mutant disease. Although, Sarah, I don't know, have you seen any HER2 mutant disease in breast cancer, Sarah?
Yeah, we actually see quite a bit. So in ER positive disease, you can see about a 5% incidence of HER2 mutations. It's a little less common in triple negative breast cancer, but it does exist. And so, you know, right now we have some data for use of neratinib, for example, in ER positive disease. There was the Summit trial that had looked at fulvestrant neratinib trastuzumab with nice efficacy. So we do sometimes consider that regimen. And now every once in a while, I will think about TDXD, you know, for these patients if I'm looking for, you know, treatment options.
Yeah, I'll be interested if anybody in the chat room has seen a patient who responded to TDXD with a HER2 mutation. I'll just show you these. You can check this out if you want to go into the chat room. We have a lot more slides to look at in terms of, we asked, what's the likelihood that you have to hold therapy using the doses that you usually use? For sacituzumab, people said about 30%, maybe 10%, although we've heard lower figures for discontinuation. And people are split between whether they use growth factors prophylactically or wait to see whether neutropenia develops. As you can see, they're about 50-50 split. In terms of TDXD, we asked them, what would it take you to stop TDXD permanently? Most people gave the same answer that investigators do, which is grade 2, although a few people said grade 3. Again, we just ask people what we do. When we ask the investigators what they do about sequencing, it falls much more in line to what Sarah and Priyanka were talking about. And finally, another question that comes up, and we talk about this a lot outside of breast cancer, I think in breast cancer we sort of stuck to try to get chest imaging as often as you can, but most people are doing that for patients on TDXD. So I just want to get all this stuff out there and really allow the chat room to start thinking about it and let me know whether you want to ask other questions, because I want to just sort of kind of get into some other issues. And some of this came out in the patient program we did last week. I just want to take a breather from sort of talking about trials and stuff and talk about taking care of patients. And then if we have time, we'll get to these last two cases. But one of the things that came out with the patients last week, one of the patients actually had been treated for metastatic disease for 5 years. She volunteers, and one of the things that for the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation, one of the things she brought up, because she counsels other patients with metastatic disease, was the issue of end-of-life care. So I was curious what Dr. Hussein had to say about him taking care of patients with metastatic triple negative and how he thinks about palliative care and end-of-life care.
Those patients, we know it's palliative. So the question is, how can I balance the toxicity with making sure the patients still have quality of life? Is it worth it to really try, you know, go with full doses first, or should I adjust? Do I feel guilty going lower? And then now we have more than one option of ADC. So how do I sequence those? The way when I manage advanced, any cancer, advanced stage, I use that example of like a baseball manager. I have a certain number of pitchers. I know I'm probably going to have to use them all, so I want to try to use them wisely. I work in a community where most of our patients are in their middle ages, 75 maybe. So I do mention that one of the options is to focus on your symptoms. I won't say we do nothing, but I say we focus on just your symptoms. We don't fight the cancer. And that's what we call palliative care. And I say, you know, on the way to hospice care. And I say, it's not wrong if you decide to do that. If you say, I live my life, I enjoyed it, I really don't want to, I don't like doctors and I want to go to hospitals. So I can help you with that too. If their performance status is bad, I learned that patients don't like to feel abandoned, but they like also to make their decision. So I give them that time. Just go home, make sure you talk to your family, think about it. I can tell you 90% of the time they call me back and say, you know what, doc, I really thought about it. I don't want the chemo. Thank you very much for your help. Like if you can help me get hospice care. So I wonder, when do they mention that, the palliative care or end of life? And how do they approach it? Do they make it one of the options? Do they mention it for every stage four? Or when they feel like really there's nothing else to give the patient?
So Sarah, you know, it's interesting also last week, the issue of patient advocacy comes up. This comes up a lot in our programs for docs where we say, look, you know, I know you're struggling with the answer. If the patient wants to be involved, let them be involved. Any thoughts about that and some of Dr. Hussain's comments and questions?
You know, it is always a challenge with trying to figure out what the right time is to transition someone from, you know, sort of therapeutic intervention to more supportive care. But I find along the journey that when I feel and when I start to feel like the patient is feeling that the benefits of therapy are probably minimal, and in fact, maybe I'm doing more harm by giving them therapy than benefit, then I really think supportive care makes sense. And so the way I always discuss it with patients is the goal of all of this therapy is to allow our patients to live better and to live longer. And if I'm sometimes, I think we get to a point where sometimes we're giving chemo and the probability of that response is just so low, and yet the probability of toxicity is far higher, then to me, it doesn't really make a lot of sense to think about further treatment. But, you know, this is a patient decision. And so to your point about, you know, getting patient advocacy, you got to get to know your patients. You got to get to know what their wishes are. Everyone has different thresholds for where they feel like they would want to make that decision. And so I think it's a continual conversation with patients along that journey to find the time that's right for them.
So Priyanka, I was struck too when he said he thinks sometimes docs feel guilty about lowering the dose, you know, kind of that mindset, particularly when you're earlier stage of metastatic disease, about being, quote, as aggressive as possible. Any thoughts about some of these challenging questions, Priyanka?
So I think, you know, we try to look at the trial level evidence, and most studies will suggest that if you have to lower the dose to manage toxicity, you do not lose much in efficacy. But I'm with Sarah where I feel like I do try to start at the full dose and be very mindful of proactive things that we may have to do to maintain that full dose for that individual patient. And if we have to reduce the dose, most patients will say, well, I don't want you to reduce the dose if it's going to work less, right? That's just a normal response. And then we can reassure the patients that at trial level, if we have to reduce the dose for toxicity, we're not going to lose out on efficacy. And the goal is for a drug that's working to be able to kind of stretch it out as long as possible. So then in that situation, managing toxicity and maintaining quality of life becomes very important.
So Sarah, we do entire programs just on PARP inhibitors. Of course, Saturday we had Katie Moore at the AON meeting talking about PARP inhibitors and ovarian cancer, but also beyond that. But Dr. Gupta, and we're just going to bring this up as part of a little bit of the tasting menu, made a comment to me I've not heard from anybody. It's just her basic observation. I really appreciate her bringing it to your attention, but I'm super curious to know whether the two of you agree or disagree with her observation.
It's pretty straightforward for patients who have germline BRCA mutation to use a PARP inhibitor after one line of chemotherapy. The question really arises, you know, when they have somatic BRCA mutation. Do you really want to replace sacituzumab with a PARP inhibitor in a patient with somatic BRCA mutation?
Any other questions for the faculty?
Why is it so hard to use PARP inhibitors in breast cancer patients as compared to ovarian cancer patients? Cytopenias are horrendous in breast cancer patients, and I don't know why that is the case. In ovarian cancer, you know, after the initial cytopenia settled, they do just fine. I've used it several times in patients who've had neoadjuvant KEYNOTE-522 regimen. So bone marrow has been beaten down so much. I think that may have something to do with it. Whereas in ovarian cancer, we just use two drugs, carbo and taxol.
So Priyanka, you know, Saturday, Katie was talking about the fact that they consider somatic equal to germline in terms of response rate, obviously other implications. I'm curious if you feel that way. And the thing that I had heard before, and again, I'm sure she sees a lot less breast cancer patients in the park because she's in lung and everything else, is her observation she thinks they don't tolerate as well. Any thoughts?
So, I mean, clearly in ovarian, there is a lot more robust data in the somatic mutation setting, but I think we have pretty decent amount of data in breast cancer from the TBCRC study to use, you know, at least olaparib in setting of somatic BRCA mutations, which can occur in about 8% or so of at least triple negatives. It's just a matter of getting comfortable using those drugs in our breast cancer patients who may be more heavily pretreated. I do have to acknowledge that if a patient has a targetable mutation, whether germline BRCA or somatic BRCA, I try to put the PARP inhibitor before I put in my first-line chemotherapy, especially if my first-line chemotherapy is going to include a platinum. They do tolerate it better. The cytopenias you manage with holding the dose and restarting. Primarily what I've seen is more of an anemia than neutropenia, right? That has been, if I've seen any, it has been primarily anemia, not neutropenia where I would need to give growth factor support. Talazoparib has more of it than olaparib. So, you know, you can kind of think about that, those two options differently based on the individual patient and their baseline level of blood counts and hemoglobin and other things.
So, Sarah, any thoughts? Also, the issue she brought up to me, I didn't put on the video of PALB2 because she'd had a patient who responded to PARP with PALB2 and ovary. They call it BRCA3, but seems like it responds. What's your any thoughts about that? And like getting back to Priyanka's comment, I want to really see what she says. You have a patient who, let's say, is BRCA, whatever, germline. Like, where is PARP going to come in a metastatic triple negative patient? With prior neoadjuvant or de novo?
Yeah, no, those are good questions. So maybe first with regards to the PALB2, we do have data from, as Priyanka was alluding to, the TBCRC-048 study that had looked at patients who had somatic alterations in BRCA or germline PALB2 mutations and looked at efficacy for olaparib. And we saw a little under of a 40% response rate for olaparib in patients who had somatic BRCA alterations. The initial data from that trial suggested maybe a 50% response rate, but now this expanded cohort had a little under 40% response rate. So it suggested, you know, very robust efficacy for olaparib in somatic BRCA mutant tumors. With regards to germline PALB2, we saw almost an 80% response rate. So really robust efficacy for olaparib in germline PALB2. So I definitely do think about PARP inhibition in patients either with germline BRCA, germline PALB2, or somatic BRCA. So I think, you know, we do need to have this information. I think it really is critical that patients get germline testing and that you know their, you know, NGS testing to know if they have somatic alterations in BRCA as well, because it opens up a new treatment option for them.
So Priyanka, getting some interesting questions and comments in the chat room. We were talking before about prophylactic G-CSF, and Lisa said she's had several instances where the insurance company refused prophylactic G-CSF and said dose reduced the SASE. I thought that was very interesting. Also, Abdul, who brought the case up before, wants to know about sequencing of olaparib and SASE. Priyanka?
So I think if you have a triple negative patient that has either a germline BRCA, a somatic BRCA, or germline PALB2, and I would say the same for a patient with hormone positive disease, I like to situate the PARP inhibitor before I go to any IV agents, which, you know, SASE would be one of them. Especially patients that have hormone positive disease, they've been coming off so many oral therapies, a transition to an IV drug is a big step in both mentally and emotionally for the patients. We do have some indirect data that also suggests that, you know, from our phase 3 PARP trials, that these drugs may work better if we put them before chemotherapy. So my preference would be to use them first before we go to SASE. And the time to response for PARP inhibitors is same as generic chemotherapy. So we know very soon if it's not going to work, and we have to make a move to something else.
Priyanka, quick follow-up. This came up again with Katie on Saturday, the issue of AML and MDS from PARP inhibitors. We're using PARP inhibitors in breast cancer in the adjuvant, neoadjuvant setting? Any, do you bring this up to patients? Any data we have right now?
So I think the most robust level of data we have is from the adjuvant PARP inhibitor study, right? The Olympia AD. And in that study, there's absolutely no increase in AML MDS in the PARP versus placebo arm. So that does give us some reassurance, given it's only a year of therapy. So when we're talking about patients with metastatic disease that have had exposure to many other drugs that can predispose to secondary leukemias, it may be a little bit hard to say, but at least in curative setting, I think we can say with good confidence that there is no excessive risk.
So, Sarah, we were talking before, like it seems like a lot of times I'm just sort of racing through the data and management questions and barely get through half the topics we have. And maybe, again, it was this program we did on patients that made me think a little bit more about that. I was talking to both of these docs about it. Just take a breath of fresh air and listen to what Dr. Hussein has to say about the what he views as the art of oncology. I was asking him, you know, because the FCS has this great online counseling, psychologic, you know, support available. And he was saying, well, a lot of times he's the person who at least is starting out with that. Here are some of his thoughts, Sarah.
Honestly, I feel like the oncologist is the psychotherapist of the patient, the oncologist and their team. I do share my email with my patients just in case they have questions. I do talk to their family member. I feel that's part of the psychotherapy, because if they want me to talk to their son or daughter, their brother, I don't mind talking to them and answering questions, because they also feel that I care and my team cares, and they will encourage the patient to kind of follow the recommendations. And I think one other thing that helps, you know, some patients may be hesitant to take your advice. I offer them second opinion. It's really a family disease, a society disease. So how do you manage that? How do you deal with when patients come with 5-6 members of the family that all are interested to know what's going on and they have questions? Some patients say, can I call my son or daughter and have him on the phone? They want to ask questions. I feel those things help the patient to have that relationship, the trust relationship. So how do they deal with that? Data is important, but again, I feel like cancer is not just a data disease, because every patient is different. I mean, I don't care how much data is out there. It's very rare that you treat two patients the same way, even if they have the same cancer. I feel it is really an art, because I can tell you, like, if your patient trusts you and they like you, they do better with the treatment, because they trust that everything you tell them is to help them. So they will tolerate side effects. They will follow your guidance and they will do better. One of the things that I always was surprised with when I see the patient for the first time, when they're diagnosed with cancer, when we finish the visit, a lot of them say, you know, doc, you made me feel better today. I'm like, I just gave you bad news. It's the fear of unknown is what makes them nervous.
Sarah, any thoughts? I know you're on the other end of second opinions a lot. I'm curious how you sort of support the referring doc. And I'm curious how many family members will you allow in the room at the time, too? A practical question.
Well, it depends on how many could fit in our little exam rooms, but we don't have any rules. And I think, you know, as Dr. Hussein notes, it's nice to have the family. I think it's really important for the patient to have that support and to have another set of ears. You know, I think there's so much emotion that comes out with these visits. It's hard for patients to really, you know, process and retain everything, because again, it is just a challenging time. But it's beautiful how Dr. Hussein has really formed these incredible relationships with his patients, because I think, again, it is, you know, I've had family members, unfortunately, deal with living with metastatic disease, and, you know, watching them go through this and trying to help them go through this, you realize how critical it is to have that relationship with your oncologist, and that you do need to have someone you fully trust and know is there to support you. And so it's probably one of the most special relationships, and I think probably why we all went into this field.
So maybe keep that in mind, Priyanka, and hold your thoughts until you hear about this next case, because I can already see the palliative issues that come in. This is not just about what drug to use. Here's Dr. Gupta.
She's 66. She actually presented as an inflammatory breast, early stage breast cancer, and she's a heavy smoker. She had clinically palpable lymph nodes, and I thought that she would definitely be metastatic, but she wasn't. So I treated her with Keynote 522 regimen. She had improvement in the red blush appearance to her breast. And finally, she went to surgery and she had a lot of residual disease. As she was finishing the sixth cycle of capecitabine, she started to develop rash on her chest wall. And it started to progress rapidly. It has pretty much wrapped around her entire chest wall, including the back, and involves the right breast also. We biopsied it to confirm that it was indeed recurrence of disease. I put her on sacituzumab first. It did not do anything to the rash. I switched her to TDXD at that time, and her rash is stable. I struggle with breast cancer that comes back in the skin. It seems like nothing works for it, whether you use effective drugs like TDXD and sacituzumab. So what would be a good option for these patients? Sometimes radiation can be considered if the skin has never been radiated. But other than pain meds, wound care, I don't know what else to do for them.
Any other questions?
We all have patients who ask, you know, I only have one bone lesion and all this disease in the breast. Or, you know, what can we do about it? You know, instead of just going from one chemotherapy to another, is there anything that we can do locally and maybe radiate the bone lesion? So, you know, is there any role for definitive treatment for patients who have oligometastases and who are responding well to treatment?
So, yeah, you know, Priyanka, it's one thing to say you have recurrent disease. It's another thing to just have the kind of disease that she just described. Any thoughts?
I mean, this is unfortunately does happen, especially in the inflammatory situation. I do find that radiation does work, especially if it's non-radiated skin, BID radiation, sometimes giving CAPE with it. I think there's a small bit of data of doing it with hyperbaric oxygen that might give you some results. But this is a very challenging situation. This is right now just a rash, but where we run into bigger problems, it becomes an open wound. And, you know, skin is a continuum organ, like, so how much will you radiate and where would you put an endpoint to it? The other challenge that happens is skin that has been operated on, the blood supply is not very good. So even though we're giving systemic drugs, I fear that they're just not getting there to the level that they would need to be effective. And we really need some better treatments for this kind of resistant disease, because it really is becomes a big, big quality of life issue for the patients. So I think those are interesting situations, and I feel like we're finding more and more now because of our better imaging techniques, right? And, you know, the AJCC now has a new definition of a stage four with it, just these very low amount of metastatic disease that really have five-year survivals that are really good, especially if you have hormone-positive disease. So spot radiating it and, you know, taking a step back from multi-agent to a single-agent anti-hormone drug, maybe a consideration there. And, you know, giving the patient the shot of a potential, quote, cure, even though we might be monitoring it with very regular imaging techniques.
I'm going to give the last word to Sarah in a second about this other case, but just to mention, a lot of positive comments about Dr. Hussein. Jitendra in the chat room says, I'm delighted their docs like Dr. Hussein are still around. Kudos to him. It took 53 minutes for somebody to bring up cell-free DNA. We have a little office pool. How long it's going to take before somebody asks about ctDNA, says Abdul wants to know about ctDNA and breast cancer. Keep that in mind. But I also want you to hear about this very interesting and unusual case, which we could talk about for an hour, but we'll talk about it for just a couple of minutes. Here's Dr. Gupta again.
This is a very interesting young man, 45. He had this huge right breast mass with spikes of cancer-like material coming out from the breast. He had bulky lymphadenopathy, triple negative as an ER, PR, and HER2 was zero as well, high Ki-67. He really responded well to the frontline carboplatin gemcitabine that I used for him for PD-L1 negative disease. His breast lesion shrank. He lost all those stalactites and stalagmites after treatment. But then his disease started to come back at some point along the way. The peripheral blood ctDNA analysis showed ERBB2 exon 20 insertion.
Wow.
I gave him sacituzumab. He did well 5 months. And then when he progressed on that, I got TDXD approved on a compassionate use basis. And by that time, he had received eribulin and Doxil, and nothing was working.
I see he also had AR positive, 2 plus 80%.
I wasn't sure when to integrate, and then what exactly to give to him. To give something like bicalutamide, which seems like a weak antiandrogen. It would be good if we had some guidance in that regard.
So, Sarah, you know, exon 20, we were talking about Saturday in lung. They give it the bispecific amivantanab. I don't know if that's ever been done in breast cancer. Any thoughts about that, about this case? You know, we got into the androgen, enzalutamide, et cetera, in the program I mentioned earlier with Dr. Trena. Any thoughts on these various issues and this case?
Yeah, it's actually a very rich case because also threw the ctDNA into that too. So, right. You know, there's a lot to talk about. I think first maybe attacking the AR positivity, you know, we do see that, you know, depending on how you test for AR and what cutoff you use, it could be up to 10% of cancers that are triple negative that are AR positive. And we do have some data looking initially at bicalutamide in metastatic AR positive triple negative disease and then subsequently at enzalutamide. You know, I will say what we had participated in those trials and we didn't really see true objective responses with bicalutamide. We did see some with enzalutamide. It just, you couldn't predict who was going to get the response. They looked at this AR signature in the enzalutamide trial that seemed to enrich a bit. But I will say it's not something I typically turn to, with the exception of being someone who seems to have, you know, more of that kind of luminal AR cancer where they're, you know, not really responding to chemotherapy, a very slow growing cancer that is strongly AR positive, maybe an older patient. I will say I only have a couple patients I've done this to over the years where I've given off, you know, trial use of, for example, either bicalutamide or enzalutamide. But, you know, I haven't had that much activity. So I would say it's not something I'm routinely doing at this time. I think only on clinical trials, and we need better biomarker predictors. With regards to, you know, if someone had a HER2 mutation, then I would certainly think about TDXD if they didn't, you know, for example, if they weren't otherwise eligible because they didn't have any HER2 expression but had a mutation, I think very reasonable to think about. We do have data, you know, pan-tumor trial that looked at TDXD in patients with HER2 mutations and had about a 30% response rate. So I think reasonable to consider. With regards to the ctDNA, I will say that I am not routinely utilizing ctDNA as a monitoring assay at this point in the metastatic setting. I think it's an interesting idea, you know, kind of like a tumor marker, if you will, trying to understand is the cancer responding or progressing. I think it's something we will maybe be doing in the future as we better understand the right way to do this, what the drop in tumor fraction is that you're supposed to be using, or what the rise amount is and what time point to look at that in. But we just don't have robust enough data there. I use it more just for the NGS and trying to understand mutational profiling.
It kind of the cell-free DNA thing kind of reminds me of the pre-Oncotype days or the early Oncotype days where meetings we'd say, would you get an Oncotype on this patient? They're all medical oncologists would say no. And then we go, well, suppose the surgeon already got an Oncotype and they changed what they did. And we're like, well, why didn't you get it? And I know you investigators always go, we don't have any evidence in breast or cell-free DNA, but half the patients that you're seeing have already had it done. So are you going to ignore it or not? And some of these questions we don't have answers to. I was thinking too, you know, the prostate people are all excited about darolutamide. They say it's better tolerated. They've got three anti-androgens and they all seem to be pretty similar. So maybe that could be a consideration as well. So did we not answer the question? Because Sirsene Visa brought up the pruritus. We did not, do we not address that? Priyanka, have you seen itching pruritus with SASE?
Not that I can remember that was so bothersome that I had to do something with it. I mean, the simple thing to do is to make sure you're doing your pre-meds appropriately. It does require like the whole gamut of your H2, H1 blockers and anti-nausea medicines. And if somebody has trouble, I tell them to just stay on their Claritin or Allegra throughout, and at least for the first 2 months. One has to be also cognizant that if this shows up, let's say after you've given first line immunotherapy, you have to be cognizant that could it be related to the immunotherapy you had before and you're just having those delayed, dermal types of side effects like, you know, aggravation of psoriasis. I've seen many skin conditions show up on immunotherapy that require management different than at least I'm equipped to provide guidance on.
Wow, that is a really great point. I didn't think about it. So, Srinivasa, I hope we helped you. I'd be curious to know whether she had an IO, because that's a really great point. I want to thank Sarah and Priyanka so much for working with us today. It's great when you all walk in and we go, we're just going to hang out for an hour and see what happens. So audience, be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Priyanka. Thanks, Sarah. Have a good one.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank you.